The Tom Woods Show, episode 754.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're turning our attention back to war and the military state today with Rosa Brooks, who is the author of the brand new book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. Rosa Brooks is currently a tenured law professor at Georgetown University Law Center, where she's an expert on international law, constitutional law, human rights, and national security law. She's authored dozens of scholarly articles on these subjects. Her career has included work for international human rights NGOs, and she's spent several years as a high-level Pentagon official from 2009 to 2011, and she's got an awful lot to say about the transformation of the American military state, particularly after 9/11. Rosa Brooks, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, that's quite a provocative title, isn't it? No doubt that's why you chose it. But, you know, I guess when I first heard about this book, I was expecting it to be to lean a little bit more in the cultural direction. Like, for instance, how did we get to a point that people in the military are revered to a degree that's almost a caricature, where everywhere you go, there's a military discount, or every football game, there are military jets flying overhead, and we're standing up on the airplane. And I mean, I'm 44 years old, and I remember people being respectful toward folks in the military, but something happened after 9/11 where it's just become absolutely, it's just everywhere. Now, even though that's not in your book, let's start off my asking about something that's not in your book. What do you think about that phenomenon?
Well, it's in the book a little bit, but it's not the main theme of the book. I think right. You're absolutely right, Tom. I think post 9/11 support for our troops, as we always call them, has become a kind of civil religion in this country. And obviously, there's nothing wrong, and it's good to be respectful of the service and the risks and the sacrifice of members of the military. But we put them on a pedestal, and very few people can live up to that. And we're also I think it also sometimes operates to prevent us from asking kinds of hard questions about policies and budgets that we should ask.
Let's talk now about the main thrust of your book, though. The idea that I'm gleaning from this book is that traditionally war and peace have been two clearly sealed off categories. Either you're at war or you're at peace. And a lot of things follow from that, because during war, certain things are allowed or tolerated that are not allowed or tolerated during peace. And certain restrictions on civil liberties are more expected during war than during peace. But what we've had, particularly since 9/11, is a shift from viewing war and peace as two different categories, as thinking instead of the situation as being always war, just along a continuum.
I think that's right. I think that here's how we lawyers put it, right? We have a legal framework that applies only in wartime, and that's the law of armed conflict, and we have our fancy Latin word for it. We call it the lex specialis, which means special law. It applies in the special situation of war. The rest of the time, the lex generalis, the general law, applies, and that's ordinary peacetime law with its emphasis on due process, its emphasis on free speech, and so forth. But in wartime, the law of armed conflict is a lot more tolerant of the state and state agents using lethal force without any due process, obviously, against enemy combatants, of using secrecy, of sort of skipping the ordinary democratic checks and balances that we expect in the general law and that we have in the general law. And most, you know, we traditionally we say, well, that's okay, because we think of wars as these temporary aberrations, these short, brief exceptions from the norm, and we're willing to tolerate a degree of infringement on ordinary rights and so on because we think it's necessary and it's only temporary. We return after the war ends to ordinary law. The problem in the post 9/11 world is that it's gotten harder and harder to tell the difference between what counts as a war and what doesn't. And we've started applying that law of armed conflict framework to more and more things, which in turn moves more and more spheres of government activity, you know, out of the daylight, if you will, and into the often literally the sort of black covert world.
Can you explain exactly how Guantanamo fits into this picture? Because it does seem like a good example of a case of I wouldn't say legal limbo because the law has more or less spoken on the question, but nevertheless, it's a case where you don't have a full-fledged war against a state actor, and you have these people of, you know, who are suspected of this or that, of bad intentions, and you throw them in this place, and people argue about the legal status of it all.
Yeah, so after the 9/11 attacks, there was this debate about whether the law of war, that the protections given to prisoners of war under the Third Geneva Convention should be provided to people we captured who were from the Taliban or al-Qaeda suspects. And there was a sort of long, drawn-out battle. The Bush administration started out taking the position they don't get any protections, nothing applies to them, it's just our discretion to be nice to them or not as we see fit. Eventually, what happened is the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on this and said there is an armed conflict. They are entitled to at least some of the protections of the Geneva framework. And one of the things that happens if you're in the Geneva framework, you know, the good news is that you get some protections either as a prisoner of war or as a detainee in an armed conflict, depending on what you sort of qualify for. The bad news is that, you know, normally the state can't put you in prison unless you are being charged with something, you're tried, you're convicted, and then you serve your sentence, you're done, you're out, you paid your debt. On the other hand, under the law of war, somebody can be detained for the duration of the conflict, which again, you know, if you figure a war is typically 2 years, 5 years, maybe even 10, is one thing. On the other hand, in the context of something like a war against terrorism, it's maybe forever. And it's interesting, you know, the Supreme Court did have a little footnote on that. I think it was in Sandra Day O'Connor footnote in that opinion that I mentioned just a minute ago, in which they sort of said, you know, I think it was an earlier opinion, it was the Hamdi opinion, but not important, I suppose. But essentially what the court said was, you know, we recognize that this framework of detaining for the duration of the conflict assumes that conflicts are sort of traditional conflicts and have an end. And at the moment, at the time the court was writing, there was active ground conflict going on in Afghanistan. They said right now, clearly that is the case. They said we might have to reevaluate this assumption if this conflict sort of goes on forever, basically. So there's a little bit of a hint from the court that they recognize that there are potentially some problems if you end up applying that framework indefinitely. But that is frankly where we have gotten to in terms of Guantanamo. We have people who have been there for 15 years, some of whom we don't even think are dangerous. We just can't figure out what to do with them. And some of them have never been tried in any form of court, but we're holding them essentially because we think they're scary guys.
I've heard that early on in the war on terror, people were basically being told, we'll give you a bounty if you haul in some people that you consider to be suspicious or who may be involved in terrorist activity. So some people are just more or less arbitrarily or indiscriminately turning people in for the bounty. So you wind up with some people in Guantanamo who may in fact be terrible people and other people who are just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Is there anything to that?
That is absolutely true. And right now there are not very many people left in Guantanamo. I think the number is well under 100 at this point. But what started happening, you know, as the immediate post 9/11 panic died down and as journalists and human rights groups and so on and ultimately the courts began to take a closer look at what was going on at Guantanamo, it did become apparent that we had a mix of people there. We had a mix of people who were some really, really bad guys and some people who were just really, really unlucky guys who had, you know, pissed off some cousin or were in the wrong place at the wrong time and somebody decided to, you know, get rid of him by saying, oh, he's an al-Qaeda guy, even though it wasn't true, you know, or they just got swept up by mistake by U.S. allies and nobody ever bothered to figure out what the real story was. Partly for that reason, the military's own analysis ended up determining that quite a lot of people initially detained should be let go because they hadn't done anything. They weren't bad guys. The problem that we've been struggling with ever since then, though, is that, you know, it's people get scared. Americans get scared. Foreign populations get scared. And no matter how many times the U.S. military says, no, we screwed up. This wasn't actually a terrorist. We want to release them to your country. A lot of countries are saying, no, thank you. So it's been a sort of long struggle to find places that will accept these people. And I should add, it's fair to say that in some cases, although they were not originally enemies of the United States, after being detained wrongly in Guantanamo for 10 years, some of them are very pissed off at the United States by now.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. So it is rather a difficult position. Is it true? I mean, I don't know how much I can trust right-wing media half the time, but I've heard it said that
you can trust any media half
the time. Well, yeah, I mean, but on this particular issue, I've heard repeatedly that so-and-so was let out of Guantanamo and went on to commit terrorist acts. Are there cases of that?
There are cases of that, yeah, no question about it. I think, though, that we get more hysterical about this than we should, right? There are prisoners in the United States who commit robberies or burglaries or rapes who serve a long sentence and who are let out of jail and go on and do something else. Most of us, you know, most of them don't, you know, most of them do not commit further crimes, but some of them do. And most Americans probably do not think that that means that we should lock up all criminals forever just in case. You know, it's a risk that as a society we accept that there are going to be some percentage of people who are going to surprise us. There are going to be some percentage of people who we never locked up who are going to surprise us and commit a crime. You know, that the alternative, which is locking up a whole lot of people based solely on their hypothetical potential future dangerousness, I think is not a direction as a society that we ought to want to go in.
Let's talk about there's another point that fits into this, the thesis of your book about the way the military became everything. We look to the military to solve all kinds of problems because, as you point out early on in the book, the polling data shows that Americans have fairly low estimates of a lot of public institutions, but a fairly high estimate of the military. And what this leads to, consciously or otherwise, is an instinct to turn to the military to solve various kinds of problems that it really does not exist to solve and was not designed to solve. Now, one of these does involve foreign affairs, and that is counterinsurgency. Let's try measures other than outright fighting, outright violence, to try to see what we can do to create peace and create stability around the world. Can you give us an example or two of that and what the results have been?
Well, the results are varied, as you would expect. I think in certain areas of Afghanistan and Iraq, for instance, there were quite successful local level military led counterinsurgency efforts that focused on protecting the population from being preyed upon by warlords, terrorists, you name it, that focused on restoring responsible local governance, getting the local economy up and running. And there were some that were quite successful, sort of at least in the short run. The trouble is, of course, even those successful ones in the context of a fairly incoherent long-term national strategy in Iraq or Afghanistan ultimately sort of succumbed to the broader pressures on them. So I don't know that they're still success stories. That being said, I think it's not so much the counterinsurgency piece that is driving this expansion of the military's role, because counterinsurgency, sort of by definition, is in the context of a conflict against an insurgent group, right? So it's clearly in the context of a more traditional conflict. But what we have also seen has been the expansion of the military's role in what the military now calls stability operations, and in what it can be called sometimes phase zero operations or shaping the battle space. And here's the way the logic works. You know, the logic is, okay, we now live in a world where threats could come from anywhere and take any form. You know, that might be the form of a cyber attack. It might be the form of a, you know, bioengineered virus. It might be in the form of nuclear materials. It might be in the form of a traditional conflict. We don't know. We don't know where the threat's going to come from. Remember on September 10th, 2001, nobody's thinking about Afghanistan. In some ways, the lesson of that for the military was, you know, expect the unexpected, expect threats to pop up where you're not thinking of them. Problem is, if you think the next threat could come from anywhere and be anything, then if you're the military and you're charged with protecting the United States, you think you've got to be everywhere and do everything. And that means including doing things that have to do with preventing or preparing for conflict, building relationships with partner militaries, gathering information, generating goodwill among civilian populations so that hopefully they'll tell you things that are happening and you'll get advance warning. And as you can imagine, you know, that all makes perfect sense. The problem is that there's no limit to it. So we end up with American military personnel who are, you know, vaccinating cattle in Botswana, who are trying to create soap operas for Iraqi audiences that preach the virtues of accountable governance, trying to stop human trafficking in the Pacific. So there's no limit to it is the problem. And as you suggest, I think the other problem is that this is not, by and large, what military personnel are good at.
The second part of your book, you talk about how in the past people have tried to tame war, to try to put limits on it, to try to subject it to rules that are recognized by everybody. And this is in contrast to what seems to be going on now, where it's so unclear as to exactly the status of things. And of course, George W. Bush famously spoke of a war on terror, which seems to be completely open-ended. And this seems to run counter to what we had seen, at least up to the 20th century, in Western civilization, to try to be extremely precise when it comes to war and precise about what the rights and wrongs of it are. So can you give us, I mean, obviously you have a huge, huge amount of material about this, but what kinds of things had been done in the past to try to keep war bottled up and contained?
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And this, for me, was one of my favorite parts researching the book. Was sort of delving into the history and anthropology of how human societies have tried to draw lines between war and peace and warriors and civilians. So I'll give you a few examples. Essentially, every human society throughout history has tried really hard to do that, precisely because the things we accept and consider appropriate in wartime are often things that we think of as being immoral, if not illegal, in peacetime, you know, willful killing of other human beings. So just to give you a few examples, the amongst the Old Norse, the berserkers, who gave us our modern term berserk, were warriors who would don the pelts of wolves and bears before they went into battle, in the belief that this would help them shapeshift and take on the savage attributes of these predatory animals. The Navajo in the American Southwest literally had a different language that they spoke when they set out on raids. So the male warriors would leave their home territory, head towards whatever the enemy territory was, speak a dialect with a different vocabulary, different verb forms. And then when they came back from the raid, they would draw a line in the desert sand. They would face enemy territory, then they'd turn around facing their home territory. They'd step over that line and they'd resume the ordinary language. A lot of Native American groups actually had war chiefs and peace chiefs. So in ordinary times, the peace chief was in charge. And then during times of war, the tribes would be led by a completely different person, a war chief. When the war ended, leadership would go back to the peace chief. So a huge amount was at stake, you know, even forms of governance, who's in charge, depending on whether you're in a war or not in a war. And I think for us Americans today, you know, we still culturally like to imagine that war is this separate sphere. It's a temporary exception. You know, normal life is peace. War is the aberration. And we have our own modern rituals that we use to distinguish warriors from the rest of us. You know, like we send our recruits off to boot camp and their hair is cut and their civilian clothes are taken away from them. They wear special little colored ribbons and symbols on their chests. They name their weapon systems after predators, just like the Old Norse. We have the Reaper and the Black Hawk and the Falcon and the Predator drone itself, of course. So we, too, do all these things to try to symbolically distinguish the worlds of war and warriors from the world of peace and civilians.
I've had somebody on the show named Laurie Calhoun, who's done some work on just war theory. And I used to hold the conventional view of just war theory, that this is Western civilization at its best, looking at an issue of great moral importance and trying to subject it to standards of justice that will hold in all circumstances. But what she argues is that really, just war theory does not, in practice, really prevent any war, because there's no war maker who's going to stop and say, well, you know, it really isn't a last resort after all, so I guess I won't do it. It's not a restraint. But to the contrary, if anything, the war makers exploit just war theory. Anybody can twist his line of argument to satisfy those requirements. So actually, if anything, it validates rather than prevents war. And that shocked me, that somebody would argue that. How does that strike you?
You know, I've seen that argument. I don't entirely agree. I do think that both just war theory, but to put it more simply, you know, common sense ideas of right and wrong do act as a restraint on policymakers, not always and not as much as we'd like them to. But, you know, policymakers are responsible, especially in democracies, obviously, to their constituencies. And it's hard to do something that will be perceived as wrong. That doesn't mean that we don't have examples, the run-up to the Iraq War being one of them, where facts and arguments were distorted to justify a conflict that didn't probably make a whole lot of sense in terms of national security. But what I think has happened more recently, which I think is interesting and to me is really quite disturbing, is that in a moment when it's harder and harder to say in any principled way or consistent way what should count as war and what doesn't count as war and who should count as a combatant and what doesn't count as a combatant, you know, is a war on terrorism a war? Well, the United States says it is. Well, does that mean that it extends to everywhere there is a terrorist? Well, the United States government is basically saying that the answer to that is yes. But what happens is if you start defining war in a way that is so broad that the war could be anywhere and that anybody, including people who to most of us look like civilians who aren't carrying weapons, but the U.S. government says, well, we think they're planning some sort of unknown and unknowable future terrorist bad thing. What ends up happening is that the set of legal rules governing war take over. And those rules, as I said a few minutes ago, are a lot more permissive in terms of the state's use of lethal force, secrecy, coercion, et cetera. And just to make it more concrete, here's why it matters, right? If we say that, take a very controversial issue, U.S. drone strikes, if we say that there is an armed conflict and it extends to wherever enemy combatants are, and some of those enemy combatants are suspected terrorist operatives in Yemen or Libya or Pakistan or wherever, well, then a U.S. drone strike is a lawful wartime targeting of enemy combatants, and it is morally and legally no different at all from an American soldier on the beaches at Normandy on D-Day shooting at a German rushing towards him with a machine gun. It's exactly the same thing. On the other hand, if that law of war framework does not apply, those drone strikes are just murders. The U.S. government is murdering people around the world in sovereign countries. And we really want to know the difference, right? We want to be on the right side of that. But I do think that we have certainly seen in the last 15 years, in, you know, two administrations, one Republican, one Democratic, a certain amount of let's call this an armed conflict because we, the U.S. government, have a degree of freedom of action to do things that would be illegal if we don't call it an armed conflict. So in that sense, I think the availability of that legal framework certainly does create incentives for the executive branch to decide if you're trying to decide if something is a war or not. Why shouldn't you always err on the side of calling it a war?
Well, on that point, at one point in your book, you admit to some optimism following the election of Barack Obama with regard to foreign policy. And you even said, I think in 2009, that Obama has, I don't know if exactly how you put it, so forgive me, but something like he's put an end to the war on terror, or at least, you know, yeah, we're gonna have clarity going forward.
I was wrong.
Yeah, look, we've all been wrong about, you know, but boy, when I look back at things that I used to, wars I supported and propaganda I believed. So I say that not to cause you embarrassment or anything, but rather to ask you, what do you think happened in the case of Barack Obama? Do you think this is a man who sincerely wanted to make a change, and then he was so up against entrenched interest that he couldn't make that change? And if that's what it is, then what does that tell us about the system?
I think that's part of it. I think that in the years after between the 9/11 attacks and when President Obama took office in January of 2009, a huge segment of the U.S. government's foreign policy apparatus had kind of retooled itself for the war on terrorism. And, you know, bureaucracies ultimately end up acting to sustain themselves, right? And it does become very, very hard to shift the momentum of a large bureaucracy that is geared up to do one thing, right? And part of it, I do think, is that President Obama discovered that bringing an end to the war on terror was a whole lot easier said than done. That, I think, though, is probably letting him off the hook a little too much,
right?
Because I also think it turned out that it just wasn't that important to him. I think he cared. He didn't care that much. He didn't care enough to put the political capital, I mean, to take things like closing Guantanamo. I don't think that there's any constitutional bar to President Obama closing Guantanamo tomorrow, whether he decides to let everybody go and, you know, just airdrop them into Yemen and say good luck to you, see ya, or whether he wants to say I'm moving you all to a supermax prison inside the United States. I do not actually think constitutionally, if we accept the whole argument that it's wartime, I don't think Congress really has a leg to stand on to prohibit him from doing that. But obviously he's chosen not to do it because it would be a huge political fight, you know, and inevitably it would be like poor old Michael Dukakis's Willie Horton moment, right? Inevitably, one of those guys would get out and do something nasty and it would be political disaster. You know, so this is about political will more than anything else. There's not a legal bar. There's not some practical bar to making the changes that he originally said he wanted to change. I think ultimately he just decided it wasn't worth his time.
And unfortunately, I think that political calculation may be correct. I think a lot of times we move in circles where it's just obvious that Guantanamo is terrible. And
yeah.
So we just can't imagine that we are in an overwhelming minority when it comes to things like that. Or most people are not worried about drone warfare. They're just not.
That's right. It doesn't affect them.
Yeah.
Although I would say they think it doesn't affect them. I think that it will come back to bite us in all kinds of ways in the future. But at least in the short term, we have this happy illusion that this is something happening far, far away to bad people and we don't need to think about it.
Let's wrap up with your conclusion. I was a little surprised at where you took this in the end, where we should go and what kind of, I don't want to say compromises, but let's say coming to terms with the reality we live in, we might need to do here.
Yeah, I've sat in so many rooms full of so many smart lawyers over the last 15 years and sat there as these smart lawyers from the U.S. government, from allied governments, from human rights groups, from academic settings, just go around in circles on issues like Guantanamo and detention, on issues like drone strikes and targeted killings. And they go around in circles because they're essentially arguing about what category things go in. And the U.S. government keeps saying this goes in the war category and those rules apply. And the NGO people say, no, it doesn't. And there's no way out of that argument because I don't think the legal framework gives you an answer. You know, the one thing the law of war never does is define what counts as a war. You know, so it's a political decision to make, not fundamentally a legal decision. It seems to me that we have kind of inherited this binary legal framework. You know, we have war or we have not war. There are only two choices. And one is too permissive in terms of how much power it gives the state. The other is probably too restrictive in terms of the scale of the threats that are real threats that are out there. You know, and terrorism is a real threat and is different from ordinary crime. You know, my own take is let's acknowledge that we are operating and are likely for the next few decades to be in this world where a lot of the threats we face are in the space between what we traditionally think of as war and traditionally think of as peace. And let's come up with a set of rules and institutions that are designed for that space between instead of always trying to shoehorn things into categories that they don't fit into. You know, and let's do that in a way that's consistent with our values, but that also acknowledges the nature of the threat. And I think that's actually very doable. That sounds abstract, but, you know, we may not have time right now to talk about specifics. But I think when you drill down to specifics, it's actually not as hard as you would think. It just requires us to start by acknowledging, hey, this doesn't fit that well into existing legal frameworks. We might need to create a new one. And humans have done that in the past. We've done it ourselves in the recent past. We can do it again.
The book is How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon by our guest Rosa Brooks. I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/754, this being episode 754. Well, best of luck with this book, and I appreciate your time very much. Very interesting. And of course, we're only scratching the surface. This is a big book covering a vast array of topics and covering them quite skillfully and non-polemically. And I don't think I could have pulled that off. On topics like this, I can't help myself but going off into polemic. And, you know, you're upset in here at times, but not so that you lose your cool and lose your audience. And so that's a difficult thing to do. And I think you pulled it off very well. Thanks again for your time.
Well, thank you so much, Tom.
All right. Well, speaking of war, one area in which I'm very weak is military history. And it's mainly because I just haven't been able to get myself interested in it, even though I know that's the area most people are interested in. People hear you're a U.S. historian, they want to talk about the Civil War, and they want to talk military history, and it's just never really been my thing. I understand the importance of it and the role that it plays, but it's just not something that I do. So, how about this? It turns out a listener of the show has just started a site dedicated to that. But so far, primarily, from what I can see, it dedicates itself to studying war in the ancient world. So ancient Rome, for example, or even well before that, ancient Sumer. Very interesting. It's the site is camrea.org. Ray is R-E-A. So it's C-A-M-R-E-A.org, camrea.org. You'll see War and Civilization as the headline at the top. And I have to admit, for somebody who is not interested in military history, I was interested in reading the pieces on this site. They're really, really very interesting and very well done. And if you're a listener of the show and you're interested in these sorts of subjects, check it out. Support a fellow listener. Camrea.org, C-A-M-R-E-A.org. Linking to it at tomwoods.com/754. As the listener website mentioned, you can get a nice boost from me and lots of other goodies as well if before you get your web hosting, you check out tomwoods.com/publicity. All right. Well, I've got Hurricane Matthew all around me here, and I've got my fingers crossed that it'll be gone in time for me to hop on a plane tomorrow and head to Houston, where I'll be joining Bob Murphy on the Contra Cruise, aboard the Contra Cruise. Finally, we've been talking about it for months and months and months, and now I'm going to be joining. It's going to be, when all of us are added in, just about 90 of us going together, setting sail on this great cruise on Royal Caribbean's Liberty of the Seas. Going to have a tremendous time. I will have episodes of the show running while I'm gone. I mean, what else would I do? What am I, not going to do episodes? The episodes will be going while I am sailing away, baby. Have a good weekend.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.